Omar Samra is very intelligent and he would never do it over a phone call. He knows that if he called me and said to me, yo, Omar, do you want to row across the Atlantic? I'd hang up in his face. He knows that would happen, right? So he was much smarter than that. He was much more devious than that.
I just said I'll swing by his office and have a cup of coffee or like have a chat because there was something I wanted to talk to him about, but I wasn't willing to tell him what it was on the phone.
I'm like, absolutely, man, come on by. Come to the office, let's hang out, let's, you know, completely with my guards down. And then when I welcomed him with open arms in my office, in my humble abode, I let him in. I let the fox into the hen house.
We were almost at a, you know, like, sitting in the same way that you would sit at a dinner table, sitting like next to each other.
And he's like, look, what do you think about rowing across the Atlantic with me? I'm like, come again? He's like, rowing across the Atlantic.
It's a race that happens once a year. It's unsupported. It's 3,000 nautical miles. And fewer people have done this than people have gone to space. And I told him my motivations for it, that I've done a lot of stuff, terrestrial stuff, like, you know, climbing mountains, going to the polar regions, doing that. And while there are a lot of other mountains and a lot of big goals in that front to pursue that would stretch me, I miss the feeling of embarking on something where I feel like a complete novice.
And I'm like, this could be cool. I mean, how do we do this? Within 2 hours of chatting, we send back a filled out application and we're like, great, guys, we're ready. And they're like, whoa, what are you talking about? And we're like, yeah, we're good. They're like, it takes most teams years to make a decision of that magnitude. Are you guys certain that you know what you're doing? And we're like, no, we don't know anything. But we'll learn.
When I listened to the story of how Omar Samra asked Omar Noor to row across the Atlantic, I was taken back to my middle school days, when my friends and I would play truth or dare. But for the Omars, this wasn't some playful dare. It was a serious one that they would take on together. And to succeed, they had to build a strong partnership and the trust needed to survive. Today on State of Mind, we break down the science behind partnerships. How do people with very different personality traits interact with each other? And why do we seek human connection when things don't go our way? I'm Lubna Munib, and from Kerning Cultures Network, this is State of Mind, a deeper dive into the chilling true story of survival documented in the film Beyond the Raging Sea. Episode 5, Daring Together. Producer Ahmed Ashour begins with a game.
Describe the other Omar in 3 words.
3 words?
Yeah.
Volcanic.
Real.
Intense.
Kind.
Quiet.
Loud.
What? It's early 2010s. I think it's like, I don't know, either 2011 or 2013. And a common friend of ours basically was like, hey, you have a fro. And he has a fro, right? And you guys do ridiculous things, things that the average person just considers ridiculous. You guys should meet. And we met in Dubai, and it was immediately as if we knew each other for a very, very long time.
I think what I saw initially was a lot of flair and a lot of like extroversion and a lot of like, you know, this larger than life personality. And typically when you meet people like that, you will often wonder, is there any substance beyond this? But I could see beyond that a little bit to parts of Omar's character that he only reveals to people that are very close to him. So even though I wasn't at that degree of closeness, I could see that behind all of this, there was also a person who was, who would do anything for his friends, somebody who was very kind, somebody who was very generous.
I think we respected each other's craft. We respected each other's accomplishments, which is really nice, right? To have two people that have chosen an uncommon lifestyle get together and sort of bond over their lack of commonality, I guess you would call it, right? Is that a word? I believe it's a word. I just made it.
I have a post, actually, that I put on Instagram that day. And I wrote something saying, finally meet the infamous Omar Noor and something. But I either put hashtag Team02 or hashtag 02 or something like that. And so when we decided to do this and we were looking for what we would call our team, because each boat team has to have a name, I went back to that original post and saw that I'd actually written that. And it was actually in our sponsorship proposal in the first slide, that photo, and then the genesis of the name. But it wasn't then clear to me that, you know, this person that I meet every now and then when I go to Dubai would be a person that would become like a brother of mine.
When the Omaris described each other as quiet and loud, I wasn't very surprised. As you just heard, from the moment they met almost a decade ago, the Omaris knew that they were very different. And in 2017, Omar Samra made a post on Instagram introducing Noor as his partner on his next big adventure. He wrote, "Our personalities couldn't be more different, yet we complement each other very well. Together, I believe we make for a formidable team. Hashtag Team02, hashtag it has begun, hashtag I hope we don't kill each other."
Some people say that it's hard work to row an ocean. I think it's really relaxing when you have Spider-Man as your teammate. Awesome.
Now, Omar Samra could have asked anyone with the required physical and mental capability to row across the Atlantic with him. So when we sat down together, I just had to ask, of all people, why did he ask Omar Noor? Why did you choose him as an extrovert? Why not choose someone who maybe is in a similar character profile to you?
I knew that I didn't want to pick someone with the same character profile as me. I could have probably went for somebody who's less extroverted than Omar, potentially, like, but still an extrovert, but definitely had to be someone who's more extroverted to balance me out. But I would be lying if I didn't think that there was parts of me that were wondering, like, what on earth would I do on the row if this guy doesn't stop talking at all, or how this is going to play out under duress or like under an extended period of time when we have no one but each other.
And the concern was mutual.
Whoa, like, he doesn't talk. Holy, like, am I going to be talking to myself the entire time? This is fairly serious, right? Like, definitely the way we approach challenges, the way we approach how to deal with an emergency is like polar opposites.
And yet, opposites attracted. To better understand why this happened, I did what any person looking for a successful partnership would do. I Googled it. I can't believe I'm doing this. Okay. Why do opposites attract? Okay. First link here from a website that shall remain unnamed. Do opposites attract in relationships? Sure. And we've heard it again and again, but is there real psychology behind the popular phrase opposites attract in relationships? Sure. Okay. Why do we initially attract our opposite? Opposites may attract at first because the other person seems new and exciting. Maybe the object of your attention is a medal-winning professional snowboarder and you are an accountant. Oh, gosh. Okay. Okay, so that wasn't necessarily scientific or helpful for that matter, but I did find someone with the right credentials who can explain the secrets to the Omaris' partnership. Dr. Paul Forbes.
I'm a researcher at Heinrich Heine University in Düsseldorf. I study how stress affects our decisions and also our behavior towards others. And I study this from a cognitive neuroscience perspective. So that basically means that we try and understand the biological processes which underlie changes in behavior under stress. Most people know the idea of homeostasis from their sort of like biology lessons at school. So the idea of homeostasis is that, like, the classic example is the regulation of body temperature. So if you get too warm, then your body detects that and it goes about bringing about changes to basically reduce your body temperature. So to sweat, for example, if it's too hot, cools you down. And this idea has also been adapted to try and explain how humans go about their social environments. So the idea is that we have a level of social interaction which we crave. And with the two Omars, maybe they both adjusted their set points. So it's not like body temperature where there's a fixed level that most humans need to be at. Obviously, it's a bit more changeable, the social homeostasis set point. And perhaps the two Omars basically adjusted that set point as to try and come more into balance with one another.
And do you think physical proximity plays a role in that?
Yeah, we can talk about this idea of self-other distinction. So the extent to which you can separate your own representation of the world from other people's. So again, this is something which develops in childhood. So children of about 4 or 5 kind of don't have this idea that other people can have different representations of the world compared to their own. And so perhaps this prolonged physical proximity resulted in a bit of blurring of the self-other distinction. So so their own and someone else's representation of the world became much more synced up.
So theoretically, Omar Samra was onto something when he chose Omar Noor to be his partner on this journey. He was looking for social homeostasis or social balance. I wondered, however, if the Omars felt that blurring of their own self-other identification, given how close they were at the time.
I think extrovert and introvert is a spectrum, but me as somebody who's predominantly an extrovert, the smaller the group, the quieter I get. And Omar, the smaller the group, the more he talks.
I tend to favor situations where there's less people, and the one-on-one situations are my strength. Like it's easy for me to bond with a person on a one-to-one basis, to go deep, to get to know the person really well. And so that was an ideal situation for me because I was one-on-one for a prolonged period of time with somebody that I already at that point knew extremely well and had a lot of love for. So the people who know me, who have the opportunity to see me in that light, you wouldn't be able to tell whether I'm an introvert or an extrovert.
Interestingly, the Omars went back to their default modes after their life-threatening capsize about 8 days into the journey.
When we capsized, Omar had just finished a 2-hour shift. I mean, he was suffering, right? He just finished getting dumped under the boat and back up on the other side. He's hanging on and he is dead quiet and he's clearly struggling, right? And me being the over-communicative person, I'm over-communicating and he's not responding and I was pretty direct with him. Like, this is not a time to do a you. I think that's what I said. Like I need you to talk, right? And he's like, look, I'm suffering. I can't talk right now. I'm just trying to pull myself together.
So that's really interesting. So that would kind of fit with this idea that when the stressor then comes, then we resort back to our default mode, whatever's easiest to us, however we've learned before. And it also maybe speaks to the fact that they were trying quite hard to calibrate their social behavior to the other person, because when then the cognitive resources are limited and your prefrontal cortex basically shows reduced activation, there's an area of the brain which is involved in control. When that's then compromised, then we see this default behavior. So the introverts being more introvert and the extroverts being more extroverted. So that definitely fits with some theories that we have about stress.
So if our behavior towards others can change so easily depending on the situation, how can we build that sense of predictability and control and even trust?
There's the one theory which may be of interest here is that it's called the dialectic misattunement hypothesis. So it sounds very complicated, but it's basically the idea that the relationship quality and durations are best predicted by how similar our interactions are with other people. And they've done studies where you give people a questionnaire which measures sort of social behavior and social communication styles. And what they find is that people who score most similarly on these questionnaires actually have the longer friendships and the longer quality relationships. So I think what's important here is that there's not one style or one type of communication which is, let's say, best. But what's important is that these two communication styles are basically attuned to one another.
Turns out, the Omars worked on their attunement prior to even getting on the boat. Introducing the What If game. You probably heard the Omars talk about this game a few times over the course of the series and even the film Beyond the Raging Sea, but let me give you a quick summary. In this game, the Ermers would create these hypothetical scenarios that could happen during their journey before they even got on the boat. With each scenario, the Ermers had to talk through their collective response to make sure that they had a plan for every situation that they could think of and that they could possibly find themselves in. So I decided to play the what-if game with the Ermers and see how they would respond to a situation that actually happened on their journey. What if one Omar went into a full body cramp and couldn't move at all while the life raft was slowly deflating?
What I would do in that situation is that I would need to, you know, ask you what's going on to understand, like, what it is that you're, like, feeling and how bad is it.
I will go through our food. I will go through our drinks to understand, like, what we have and if we can give you more than what we rationed in order to try to get you out of this situation, to try to make you... again, useful.
And you need to tell me honestly whether can you participate in what's unfolding right now in the next, like, few minutes or the next few hours, so that I can understand how much more is required of me.
And in the meantime, while we do that, we'll have to figure out what's going on with the raft. You know, doesn't matter if you stop cramping if we're under the sea. So let me try to figure out what's going on in the raft while you try to, like, do a self-assessment, right? And talk to me about it. I need you to talk to me about it so I know what's going on. And then I will figure out the raft situation and keep communicating back to you in case you have ideas that I may not have, right? Like, you may come up with something, like, amazing that I just don't know about, okay? So I'm going to take care of that. You take care of you. We talk about it and we fix it one at a time.
We lived that same experience in the ocean when both of us were in the life raft. And had Omar not known how I operate in these kind of situations, and had I not known that he needed, you know, someone to keep talking back at him, to give positive reinforcement, to do all of these things, we wouldn't have been able to see it through. So it's really important to have all of these, as many live examples as possible and things that you go through, that you can use as anchor points after that to get through whatever it is that the project and the situation is going to throw at you.
Of course, beyond learning how to coexist, communicate, and trust each other, the Ermers had to learn what I would argue is the most difficult part of any partnership: empathy. Part of me is curious, how do you balance empathy and care for your partner with your own sense of self-preservation in that moment?
Sort of on a analytical, common sense level, there is far less chances of survival if one of us perishes than if we two are, you know, at it solving this thing. The first thought that I had when we capsized and Omar was stuck in the cabin was like, what happened to Omar? Did he get hit, like his head get hit really badly, and is he unconscious? Is he going to be able to get out of this thing?
I do think it adds an extra aspect, an extra level, right, of care when you know somebody. And you got to keep in mind, like, the way that this relationship was forged very quickly. We were acquaintances. We were buddies, okay, up until we decided to sign on to this thing. And then it was fast track from buddies to, you know, the closest relationship you can possibly have with somebody, right? Like, almost dying together and having to rely on each other. And there's certain things you simply cannot explain.
My relationship with Omar and how close we were and how close we had become, having gone through all of these life experiences together, contributed to the empathy. When you know someone, when you know his family, when you know his partner, when you know so many people that will be affected if this person dies, and when you understand how you're going to be affected if you lose that person, yeah, of course it pushes you much harder to do things.
So we have this idea of oxytocin and the endogenous opioid system, and these two systems could basically be involved in promoting social behavior following stress, and they can also boost the stress and reducing effects of social support. There's a classic study where they basically stress people in the lab. they basically put people through a tough job interview. So they have to give this job interview in front of a panel, and the panel are all in lab coats and aren't really giving you any positive feedback. And they get you to do some difficult math tasks as well. And then they give them the chance to have social support, so they give them a friend to talk to. And what happens is that if you then administer oxytocin with this social support, what we find is that this oxytocin boosts the stress reducing effects of this social support. And you see the similar effects with pain as well. So if you put people in pain and you give them social support, it can also reduce the pain that they're feeling. And I think in turn, then helping other people when you're stressed can actually then also downregulate your own stress. So it basically reduces your negative emotions that you're experiencing because you've been kind to somebody else. And so in terms of the Omars, perhaps they also showed increased pro-social behavior towards each other. I guess the slight caveat there being, and maybe it's actually quite evolutionary said, it's quite a realistic situation because it was about life or death. So it wasn't just the fact that they had to be pro-social to be nice, but it maybe also was in their interest to be pro-social because it was going to get them through this experience. So I think there's definitely the case that we can be more pro-social under stress, not always. And when exactly we're pro-social and when exactly we're antisocial is an area of research which is ongoing, and there's not really been a clear picture which has emerged. But I think what's important to emphasize is that there are these mechanisms, biological and psychological mechanisms in place, which can promote this pro-social responding in stressful situations.
As I listen to the Omars reflect on their friendship and partnership, I was reminded of this really cliche and overused quote by the Dalai Lama. We humans are social beings. Now bear with me. I never really believed in that generalization, but I think I believe in it a little bit more now. Take, for example, a situation in which you do not have any social connection.
This film Castaway with Tom Hanks, where in the film, he's basically stranded on this island and he doesn't have any social interaction. And then he basically creates this friend, Wilson, out of a volleyball. And I think that's a really nice example where people try and form connections, even with inanimate objects like a volleyball, when they don't have this social connection.
I took this epiphany to the Omars and asked them, if we humans are social beings, then what does a successful partnership look like?
For Omar Noor, the successful partnership is over communicating, over sharing, talking through things, really being like very open about everything, right? However, through this experience, things changed because that is not how Omar operates, right? Omar is not an over communicator. Omar is not interested in filling space, for example. So what that taught me that a good partnership is not just finding somebody that works in the same manner as you do, because there is no such thing as 100% sync. There's no such thing. So the skill of having a good partnership is being able to see the point of view of the other person and understand how they function.
It's also having a relationship where there is a sense of respect to what each person brings to the table, that you complement each other in that way, that, you know, that because of that relationship, you will become a better person. And that comes through, you know, the other person feeling comfortable enough to challenge you and to tell you things sometimes you don't want to hear. I think if you're able to achieve those things, then you have like a relationship that can really stand the test of time and potentially a capsize in the ocean.
Next week, on the last episode of State of Mind,
it was a conversation with something bigger than myself saying, no, 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 not like this. I don't want to die like this. This is not the way I pictured it. Not like this.
This episode was produced by Ahmed Ashour and edited by Dina Sabri. Research and fact-checking by Dina Sabri with additional support from Imane Sharif. Sound design by Munzer Al-Hashem, and I'm your host, Lubna Munib. State of Mind is a production of Koenig Cultures Network. Subscribe to the show if you haven't already. And before you leave the app, please leave us a review. It makes our show more discoverable, and we read every single one. Promise.